I'm John Batzer with my colleague Cleo Pascal of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Where in the world is Cleo? She's in New Delhi right now, a long way from the Indo-Pacific, but it's part of the Indo-Pacific Command. All of these island, commonwealth, sovereign states are at issue between the U.S. and its allies with China. The game is get a state to declare allegiance to Beijing and not Taipei. And therefore, you've influenced decision makers and you can move in with your apparatus. That's the game. Right now, we're going to a small series of atolls with an island called Tuvalu. Population overall, all of the territory is about 12,000, according to the most recent summit. It has a prime minister now in question. It is part of the Commonwealth, so Charles III is monarch. Cleo, Tuvalu just held an election. What to take from an election where, with 12,000 people total, we're looking at 6,000 voting, good for them, and at the same time, there are no parties, there are only 16 members of parliament, and there's been a surprising change of direction. The prime minister has lost his seat. What does this mean in terms of the contest between China and the U.S.?
So in this case, in this zone, the U.S. has delegated the strategic point position to Australia. And it's hard to say it's been anything other than a disaster. This is, the Solomons recognized Taiwan, and then in 2019 it flipped to China. The same thing with Kiribati, which is Tuvalu's neighbor. Nauru just flipped. These are all countries that the Australians are supposedly taking the point on. And in the case of Tuvalu, a couple months ago, they signed a deal with this prime minister who's lost his seat, which was a lousy deal. Tuvalu is very concerned about what's going to happen with sea level rise. In their conception, they might have to abandon some of their islands. So Australia used that desperation to say, okay, we're going to allow in maximum 280 Tuvaluans a year. And in exchange, we're going to get effectively defense veto over your countries. But, don't worry, we'll come and defend you in case of war or things like that. In spite of the fact that their military is already so overstretched, they can't even get to the Red Sea. And it's very unlikely to be a situation where Tuvalu is attacked, but Australia isn't. And if Australia is attacked and Tuvalu is attacked and they're overstretched already, it's not like they're going to send their military, a couple thousand or however much it is, kilometers away to defend Tuvalu. It was an egregious deal. And what I personally didn't like was it was pushed through at a top level government to government basis with no plebiscite in Tuvalu over what was a fundamental change of its sovereignty, which gives a precedent to China to do exactly the same sort of thing. To say populations don't matter, you can buy off or pressure or make a deal with the right top two or three people, and that's it. Anyway, it was not popular domestically, and there was an election, and the guy lost his seat. And now we'll see who the new prime minister is. But one of the potential candidates has already talked about de-recognizing Taiwan and shifting to China. And the other one has talked about walking away from the deal with Australia.
And Australia is in this mode because there was a change of government. Albanese has been traveling. Is this again, as you mentioned before, Australia romancing Beijing and therefore it's not keeping up its connection with other parts of the Indo-Pacific?
No, Australia's positions in the Pacific Islands, I think, are the result of multiple different factors. In this case, I think it was at least in large part, arrogance and to some degree condescension, but it feeds into what they see their view of their position in the region as being, which is the intermediary for everybody else. So I'm here again at this India-US forum meeting, and Chatham House rules, so I can't say who said it, but it was presented as Australia being the essential conduit through the Quad into the Pacific Islands. And so they want to be able to put out press releases where, you know, Australia did this deal or Australia did that deal, so that all of the other partners have to go into the Pacific through Australia. But their approach is, you know, fundamentally barely post-colonial. And their idea, and this is stated, you know, in sort of a white paper they put out a few years ago, that their goal is security and economic integration with Australia and some degree New Zealand. So they'd like the Australian dollar to be used across the region. They'd like the local militaries or police or whatever to be subsumed into an Australian security architecture. And it's just it's really barely post-colonial, and it's just not going to work. And it also assumes that the Australian defense and security sector have the same goals as the Americans or the people of the region themselves. And we've seen Australia vacillate on China. And if you're giving them the space to try to do that, you're assuming a consistency of Australian policy, which I would argue historically we haven't seen to be the case.
We go from the South Pacific to the North Pacific, and the question of the U.S. Congress moving a relationship that requires funding. These are the three important independent states that depend upon the U.S. for defense: Palau, Federated States of Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. When last we spoke, Cleo, the money and the compact were held up pending Congress's decision about much defense appropriation. Has the story moved in any fashion?
Yeah, so this zone, which is a massive zone in the Central Pacific between Hawaii and Guam, which currently the U.S. has extensive defense and security rights, including strategic denial. And it's what allows Indo-PACOM to get unmolested from Hawaii to the treaty partners of Philippines, Japan, South Korea.
Think of them as stepping stones across a river. First the Marshall Islands, first the Federated States of Micronesia, then Palau, then the Philippines, and then Japan and Taiwan. Boom, 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 boom. Please continue, Cleo.
Right. And they're stepping stones that are soaked in American blood. We're coming at this is the 80th anniversary of the battles of Kwajalein. That'll be this month. Truk Lagoon, Peleliu, Angar. You know, then if you go up to the Commonwealth of Northern Marianas, Saipan. I mean, this is this relationship with the U.S. was born in blood. And the agreement with them now is, yes, there are these extensive rights, but also people from the region can come and work in the U.S. They're so close. They have U.S. zip codes. But there's also financial support for just the operations of their government, paying for teachers. The agreements are renewed periodically. The amounts have been decided. Now the package is sitting in Congress waiting to be approved, and it's been put into that same package as the border bill, Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. That bill that's incredibly controversial and may not pass. It's already late.
We have 30 seconds. Palau's out of money. What are they going to do?
Palau's looking to borrow money, and the Chinese are on the ground saying, and the president has said this, blank check if you walk away from the U.S.
So the Chinese are waving their checkbook in Palau's face. Is Palau smiling or frowning?
The Senate in Palau has already said that they don't want Patriot missiles to be based in Palau. It's already starting to have an effect on U.S. defense posture in the region.
Cleo Pascal in New Delhi for the India-U.S. Forum, commenting on the Indo-Pacific. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Besh.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor,